everybody. Welcome to this week's edition of Daily Coast, The Brief, your weekly show about politics. I'm Marcos Molitzis. I'm here with Carrie Alleveld. And today we're going to be talking, I think it's going to be a fun show. We're going to be talking about Joe Biden's and the Democratic Party's improving chances as we head into November. Nothing that Carrie and I haven't talked about before, but the numbers are starting to sort of like support us. We were sort of hypothetically theorizing, and now we're seeing actual tangible data that confirms this idea that yes, that things are looking better for us heading into November. We're also going to be talking about the crack up of the Republican Party. That's part of the story. I don't think you can separate those two. The fact that the Republican Party is in the midst of a civil war is a factor in their electoral difficulties heading into November. And that shows up in their money and their polling and in lots of different ways. Their shrinking House majority, potentially shrinking Senate caucus. Oh, we got so much to talk about. Carrie, thanks so much. It's always so good to chat.
It's fun. It's fun to be here under like pretty good circumstances in terms of like, this is kind of like, you know, everybody was like, well, I don't know, after Joe Biden's like really solid and like feisty State of the Union performance, people were like, well, we don't see an immediate bump in approvals, right? But now we're actually seeing, you know, it takes a few weeks for things to sink in, not just in, I mean, there's a lot of campaigning going on too, at least the Biden campaign is campaigning, you know, and so, you know, the fundamentals are starting to get better. Like this is the approval ratings and particularly the head-to-head races against Trump are a lagging indicator of where things are, right? But we're starting to see the fundamentals underneath improve. So anyway.
All right. So before we get into those fundamentals, I'm going to ask you about those fundamentals. So the State of the Union address was a sort of turning point for a couple of reasons. One is it shut down a narrative that Joe Biden was too cognitively declined, addled to be an effective candidate. And one, he blew that out of the water, but it also really, he shut that down in the New York Times because the New York Times they were literally running like 5 stories a day on how Joe Biden was old. They really thought they had the scoop of the century there.
You can't get anything past those New York Times reporters, Marcos.
Scooped us all. We had no idea. But two, it actually really threw a wrench in the Republican narrative, right? Because that was, they had built everything around this idea that Joe Biden was cognitive decline. And then he makes a mockery of them. They literally had to shut the lights off on him.
Yeah.
Because all the Republicans.
He was too mean.
He was too mean, and they needed to go to bed early because it was getting too late. So they shut down the lights while Joe Biden was still basically throwing a party on the floor of the Congress.
Totally.
So that changed things. So one, it shut down that narrative. So suddenly the media coverage is like, okay, like, there's not much here to talk about Joe Biden. And oh, look at that Donald Trump. He's back in court as usual. And one of the first indicators of what I'm sure we're going to talk about, Carrie, money. You had a bunch of financial reports, and it turns out that the Democrats are systematically and dramatically overperforming Republican fundraising numbers at the Trump level, at presidential level, the super PACs that support them, the Senate and House caucuses of each party, the governors, like go down the list. Like everybody is dramatically, it's not even close. It's like 2-1 Democratic, yeah. Republican advantage in the aggregate. So I don't know if you have numbers there handy to reel off,
well,
but
oh yeah, let me just look at a couple of them, and I don't have them memorized, but I do have them in front of me. So for instance, you know, these are February filings, right? These are filings for what the campaigns took in during February and what they had cash on hand at the end, what they had banked, right? And you know, in the Biden campaign is lapping the Trump campaign. They are basically doubling what Trump's doing. Also, BTW, like their money is actually going to campaigning and not to paying legal bills. So that also matters.
We joke, but it's not a joke.
No, it's not a joke.
They literally spent more in lawyer fees than they brought in.
For real. So in the month of February, the Biden campaign brought in $21.3 million, while the Trump campaign raised $10.9 million. Okay. Jeez. So basically double, right? And then the DNC raised $16.6 million. the RNC raised 10.7. So not double, but still, you know, a solid
40% more. Yeah,
right, exactly. So at the end of the day, when you look at what they have cash on hand, Biden and the Democrats have, you know, double effect. No, more than double what Republicans have. So they have a combined $97.6 million cash on hand. And Trump and the Republicans, the RNC, have $44.9 million cash on hand.
Brutal.
So it's brutal. It's brutal. And, you know, and then you go through the DCCC, right, has more than $14 million cash on hand.
The DCCC, the House caucus, so House Democrats.
Yeah. Oh, sorry. Yeah. Yes. The DCCC is the House Democrats. So they have more than $14 million more than what the NRCC has. And that's the Republican counterpart, right? So it's the DTRIP has $59 million and the Republicans have about $45 million. They both have just above that. But like, you know, we're ahead of them there. The place where they're a little closer, where Republicans are a little closer, and I tell you, there's been reporting on this. There's been a lot of Republican donors who have just said, I'm not going to fund Donald Trump's campaign. I'm not doing it, but I'm going to turn my attention to the Senate, right? So they're going to try to make their mark in the Senate. So I think this is why you're seeing not quite as much disparity among the senatorial campaigns, but the Democrats in the Senate Democrats, have a $7 million cash on hand advantage, which is an advantage, but not like a giant advantage. It's $31.9 million to $24.8 million for the Senate Republicans. But I think the Senate Republicans are
39 to 24 is still a pretty big disparity.
Yeah, it's 31.
Oh, 31 to 24.
31.9. So, I mean, it's effectively
about a third more.
It's effectively 32 million to 25 million. I mean, that's effectively what you're looking at. So
I don't think it's a coincidence also that that's the last committee that has a traditional old school fundraising juggernaut Republican in charge, and Mitch McConnell.
Right.
They've been systematically purging Republicans. MAGA has been systematically purging these Republicans that actually can raise a lot of money. And Mitch McConnell's done. This is his last cycle. So as leader, and I think once you're not leader, you're like, screw it. I'm not going to raise the money.
Absolutely. Well, and this is sort of, I feel like Senate Republicans, I mean, they're in the midst of an upheaval too, but they're kind of like the last bastion of the establishment of Republicans in Washington, right? The so-called establishment, right? I mean, the truth is that Trump is really the establishment now, but he's owned the House Republicans for a long time. He owns the state parties. He now owns the RNC. And the last sort of bastion of this last sort of glimmer of what the Republican Party kind of used to stand for in terms of like a hawkish foreign policy, supposed fiscal fiscal responsibility. I mean, I say supposed because come on. But anyway, this idea, right? They're really just tax cutting. It's not fiscal responsibility. It's really just tax cutters, right? Tax cutters for the rich in particular. The glimmer of what Republicans used to be, the last place for them to have any sort of foothold is in the Senate Republican Conference. And they're losing that as we speak. McConnell's soon to be, you know, his announcement of his resignation, his final term, right, as leader of the caucus is, you know, is a signal that there's a changing of the guard. And there's an actual, you know, fight over what this Republican caucus in the Senate is going to look like. And we got a glimpse of how bad it's getting this weekend from Senator Lisa Murkowski in Alaska, right? Where she did this sort of off the cuff interview with CNN walking the halls of Congress and was like, you know what? Trump isn't my guy. I'm not voting for him. And then when she was asked whether or not she might, you know, leave the party and caucus with, you know, become an independent and who knows, potentially caucus with Democrats, she was like, you know, she basically said, and I don't have the exact quote for right now, but she basically said, I'm not going to comment on that. I'm navigating an interesting time in American politics right now. So she just did not take off the table this idea of switching to independent, which she's done before, but she did it to win an election. And then, you know, potentially caucusing with the Democrats, because frankly, the MAGA Republican Party is just too gross for her. She just cannot stomach it.
Yeah. And just being this in a house where there's actually a non-zero chance that Hakeem Jeffries, the Democratic leader, may become Speaker of the House before the end of the year, because we just had another Republican quit, and not just quit, but quit the day after the date that would require an immediate special election. So basically it's punting until November, which would mean that seating in January. So these are establishment Republicans that are just sort of fed up and are just walking away, but doing it in a way that damages the MAGA majority, which is actually, that's the kind of thing that's amazing. Yeah. They're not just retiring. They're not just, they're quitting and are doing so strategically in a way to create damage. And if Ken Buck of Colorado, who quit on Friday, if he's to believe, there's more of these people. There's right. more and Republicans ready to quit.
Yeah. Mike Gallagher already said that he's, I think he's from Wisconsin, already said yes. that he's not going to run for re-election.
No,
I don't think he's going to.
Yeah. No, no, he quit. And he did. So his resignation date is the day after the deadline. Yeah, that's Gallagher. So he's doing it in a way to maximize the damage to the Republican MAGA leadership, Mike Johnson. So you only need two more of those. And we actually may have a Hakeem Jeffries. So we are in sort of unprecedented territory. And so you have in the Senate, you have sort of the same dynamic. There aren't that many moderate Republicans left. You have Mitt Romney's on his way out, and he'll be replaced by some MAGA nutbag in Utah. I suspect, and not to get in a tangent, because I want to get back to the 2024, but Lisa Murkowski may be waiting to see what happens with ranked choice voting, because Republicans are trying to put that on the ballot. Right now, ranked choice voting gave us a Democrat in the House in Alaska, defeating Sarah Palin. And so Republicans are trying to defeat it at the ballot box. If it survives, if ranked choice voting survives, I suspect you're going to see Murkowski become an independent, because she'll be protected by ranked choice voting. The system sort of does protect moderates in a way that up and down does not. So,
and I agree with your point. And I will say the other thing she's probably keeping an eye on is who's going to actually succeed Mitch McConnell as leader, right? Because John Thune is up for that. He's actually like, I think, a legit sort of Mitch McConnell type establishment guy who occasionally says, you know, things that Donald Trump and other Republicans clearly wish he wouldn't. You know, another name in circulation is maybe John Cornyn, but John Cornyn's a much more go along, get along type of guy. I mean, maybe, you know, he's not Ted Cruz, but I don't think he's not going to stand on principle for anything. That guy's not going to stand on principle, you know? So then, you know, there's other people like, I don't know who they're talking about, but does Rick Scott want to make a run for that?
He does want to make a run for it if he survives the election. And let's put a pin on that conversation, because that's a conversation for another day. I want to get back to 2024. And so one of the things that people have been freaking out early on is the poll numbers, that Biden is lagging. Now, if you look at the actual poll numbers themselves, both candidates have been in the mid-40s. So like Trump 44, Biden 43 or 40, like, and they, you know, one or down a couple points. My argument has been that this is Trump's high watermark. He cannot get better than that. There's nowhere for him to pick up votes. On the other hand, Biden does have room to grow, just because he's the incumbent and people are sort of like, you know, nobody likes the incumbent so much. Biden himself has, for multiple reasons, and some which I actually don't understand, he hasn't been able to really take credit for a lot of the good things that have happened the last several years, whether it's, you know, taming inflation, whether it's the job market, the stock market, all these things, you know, things look on paper pretty good. And so people could talk about the vibe session, right? And so whatever the vibe session is. But Carrie, even the poll numbers are starting to look better and better, aren't they?
They are starting to look better. So, The Economist made some waves last week when they sent around their presidential polling average showing that Joe Biden had actually taken a 1-point lead in their polling average for the first time. Now, this was a little bit, you know, like, I don't know, more bullish or a little bit more positive than some others. But there's no doubt that since, I mean, I really think this State of the Union was kind of like a turning point for multiple reasons. One, like you said, it sort of killed this narrative about Joe Biden isn't up to the job, right? But then also, like, one of the narratives was Democratic support for Joe Biden is a little soft. Well, I think what we're seeing is in the wake of the State of the Union is, you know, people getting clearer about what the choices are, right? Getting clearer about what we have is this rematch between Joe Biden and Donald Trump, and then these third party groups who could be a spoiler, you know, for potential Biden reelection, right? And then you see Democrats starting to come home in these polls, and you also see Republicans doing the same. So we're starting to get a more realistic look. And I don't even think it's realistic yet, but
until the convention. That's the other thing we've been saying for months now.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And even then it's a little bit of a crapshoot, because who the hell knows who's going to turn out in this election? But anyway, let's move that back to a further day down the road, right? But like I just went and I said, well, what the heck? Let's look at the 18 polls that have come out since the State of the Union. And just look at the head-to-heads, not the ones that are including multiple names and the third-party candidates. Let's just look at the ones, the reputable pollsters in 538's average. You know, anyone who's a pollster who's like 1.8 stars and above, essentially 2 stars and above. And just look at what they have. And in those 18 matchups, the breakdown was that Trump led in 9, Biden led in 7, and 2 were even, right? Now, if you look at the 18 polls leading up to the State of the Union, it was like marginally better for Trump. Trump led in 10 versus 9, Biden led in 6 versus 7, and 2 were even. So you can see, and the other thing is that, and this is even probably a more important point, but it feels sort of nominal in a way. The average of these polls shows Biden improving overall from 1.1 percentage points underwater before the State of the Union to 0.8 points underwater afterward. Now, that seems like a negligible shift, but it's a meaningful shift in terms of averages, right? An average of a bunch of numbers. So, you know, you have that happening. And then also, you know, I just want to make a point here, because we, you know, our Daily Coast Civics monthly poll showed this month that that Biden was 1 point ahead of Trump. Okay, so 45 to 44. In January, it was tied. Okay, but here's what you see happening when you look at the crosstabs. In January, 88% of Democrats said they would support Biden. By March, 90% said that. Okay, same thing for Trump. In January, 90% of Republicans said they would support him. Now 92% say they would. Okay, so these are people coming home. But what was most fascinating was the shift among independents, who favored Trump by 11 points in January. But this month, Biden cut Trump's lead among independent voters to just a handful of points. So now Trump is leading Biden among those voters 42% to 37%, right? But that's a big difference. Trump winning independents by 11 points versus winning them by 5 points is a big difference. And I don't think it's going to stop there. Like, I think that shift is going to continue. So anyway.
Yeah. The big one that I still think is going to be, it's going to shift numbers quite a bit. First of all, is people still don't think it fully internalized that it's Biden versus Trump. Like this, I think the conventions are going to lock that in. But the other big piece is the abortion one, and people not realizing that Donald Trump is the reason we don't have national abortion rights anymore. Still a lot of people think that it happened under Biden, so it's Biden's fault. Yeah. There is a people who don't pay attention or just peripherally do so, don't understand the nuances of how Donald Trump installed the Supreme Court justices that then, you know, a couple of years into the Biden administration, eliminated abortion. That's the sort of thing that's going to be messaged relentlessly through the end of the election. And I think a lot of those independents are actually going to start shifting over as they realize that abortion rights are that Donald Trump is who Donald Trump is. And if Donald Trump, you know, it's so funny because the other piece is hearing Donald Trump talk. The more people see and hear him, the more I think it's going to actually help Joe Biden. This has always been a long-running frustration with Trump advisors where they just kind of wish he would shut up, because every time he opens his mouth, his numbers go down. When he shuts up, the numbers go up. And right now we're in a place where he actually isn't doing that much public events. In fact, his last rally was on the 15th. So we're almost going on 2 weeks without a rally.
Wait, didn't he do a rally like last night or two nights ago where he was just crazy?
No, he'd been walking out of the courtroom. So in the context of
sorry, not a rally.
Another courtroom appearance, okay. Not exactly a winner. But what happened is they're out of money. They don't have money for rallies. And I wonder if that actually helps in a weird way, may help Donald Trump.
Because
he was bragging, it was just mind blowing, right? We're in campaign season now. This is it. And Donald Trump on Sunday wrote on his Truth Social a tweet basically bragging about winning two golfing trophies. So he spent the weekend golfing. They let him win because he's fucking Donald Trump. And then he thinks he like actually won something.
Yeah.
Freaking hilarious. Like even Joe Biden's social media accounts were making fun of him for nuttiness. But if you look at his campaign schedule on his website, still zero. There's no campaign events.
Look, in the meantime, Biden started like barnstorming the country, right? In particular, swing states. So he now has made it in the last 3 weeks since the State of the Union to every swing state. I don't know if that was five or six, but it basically every swing state. The Associated Press reported on it. While Trump is busy golfing, right? Biden's out there hitting every swing state, doing a whole bunch of meet and greets with people, chatting with voters.
Getting local media coverage, which actually has a meaningful impact on numbers. Political science 101.
Yeah.
Beats the hell out of paid ads.
That's right. Beats the hell out of paid ads. And Biden is, I mean, the State of the Union, I don't think we can really overstate this, right?
No.
The State of the Union really was a reset. And so also this idea that like, who's, you know, there was this narrative that Biden was like running a basement campaign, right? The person running the basement campaign now is Trump. Biden's out there.
Yeah.
And I just want to read a couple of, I was listening to Sarah Longwell's podcast, The Focus Group, right? And she did a group of Trump to Biden voters. They voted for Trump in 2016. They voted for Biden in 2020. And, you know, there had been this like complacency, I think, among a lot of Biden voters, whether they were previous Trump voters or they were first time voters for Biden or they were Democrats. You know, it's a little bit of complacency pre State of the Union. OK, here's just a sampling of what some of these voters said. And these are actually pretty highly engaged, highly informed voters who get their news through like a multitude of different, you know, media, different outlets. But here, just listen to this. This person said, I thought he was energized, chuckling. And that's one of my biggest complaints about him. You know, not the age so much. It's just, he's not like an enthusiastic, energized guy. He made a couple of jabs at like Lindsey Graham, which comes off good in this day and age. And sometimes you could tell he was going off script, which is good. He was, you know, flowing improv, which is good. He's showing he's competent. And then there's another person who said, it was the most that I've seen him be able to go off script that I can remember. This to me felt like he was going off script. He was showing that he can do it, that he can do it well, which was a pretty good thing. And I mean, to me, that answers some of the questions that people were having and have made about him in the last couple of months. And then there was one other person who said he suffers from a stutter. So a lot of times he stumbles over words and it can be a little uncomfortable to listen to him. But I thought he sounded really sharp. He was very strong. He did go off script, but he was handling the hecklers really well. I mean, he needs to win those voters back who defected from
hecklers.
Trump.
Those hecklers don't realize that they were actually helping Joe Biden. I mean, this is like, they did last year. Marjorie Taylor Greene did last year, and she did it again this year. They're that freaking stupid.
Yeah.
You know, it's ironic, too, because Joe Biden, his whole career, his problem was that he'd go off script and then say something really like just off the wall weird. And now it's actually playing to his benefit at the twilight of his career. So
yeah.
I'm glad that's working out. So let's sort of broadly recap. OK, so money. what is going to change money-wise for Donald Trump? Like, I don't see it. The donors aren't particularly interested in paying for his lawyer bills. He installed his daughter-in-law at the RNC, and they squashed a motion by committee members that would have prevented the RNC from paying Donald Trump's legal bills. They killed it. The MAGA people killed it, right? So I don't think donors are really interested in paying Donald Trump's legal bills. And they're not, I'm not sure how much money they're actually raising. We're going to find out April 15th is the next reporting period. Right. So in a couple, three episodes away.
The reporting suggests that they've taken a hit. The Trump campaign has taken a hit, both on small dollar fundraising from the grassroots, but also on this big dollar donors, right? So, I mean, they're getting hit from both sides now. And so,
Carrie, I saw a news report where his campaign was bragging that they talked Donald Trump into spending like 3 hours doing call time sometime during the week. Like,
wow.
These candidates, like, you literally spend like 8 hours a day on the phone. It's the work. Like, running for office is like, God bless everybody who does it, because it's not easy work.
Yeah, I think they got to spend like 80 to 85% of their time.
On the phone.
Maybe even 90% of their time, doing call time. And then when they're not doing call time, they're doing interviews with reporters or doing campaign stops. And that's it. Like, that's their whole life.
And so Donald Trump's not even bothering to call people. And I think his numbers suggest that. And the reporting on small dollar donations to the Trump campaign is absolutely abysmal. It has fallen off the cliff. All Republicans, they've grifted them so hard. Donald Trump today was grifting Holy Bibles. They've grifted them so hard that they've sort of, they're tuning it out. And so money's going to be tight, I suspect. Now, money's not determinative. Hillary Clinton raised more money than Donald Trump did. So we all can't sit there and celebrate, okay, because money don't vote. But it's a big part of it. So number two, poll numbers.
Right.
In 2020, Donald Trump got 46.8% of the vote. You said, like, the poll numbers right now, the aggregate has him about 45. Like, I wouldn't be surprised if he got up to where he got up to 46, around 46. Now we have all these Haley voters who say they're not going to vote for him. It's not going to happen. Like you said, he's at 92% of Republicans, but a lot of those Haley voters may have dropped off and not called themselves Republicans anymore.
Sure.
Right? So it makes this stuff so complicated. It's not always the apples to apples comparison. So the best we can do is sort of kind of vaguely guess at it. But he's not growing his base. He's maxed out. As far as we can tell, he's maxed out the nihilistic, white, rural, disenchanted vote.
Yeah, I'm telling you that his theory of the case, and this is something I brought up with Sarah Longwell when we had her on a couple times ago, right? Is that they're trying to replace these voters that they're not getting back, these sort of mostly suburban, fairly highly educated, informed voters. They're not getting them back. And they probably are even losing some of them. Some of them were Haley voters this time, mm-hmm. who, other than Trump, probably would vote Republican, right? Yeah. And he's probably going to shed more of them. And they think what they're going to do is replace these voters with working class Latinos and Black voters, for reals. Like, this is what... Longwell was like not as dismissive of it as I was. I mean, I worry more about Black voters who potentially don't think that Biden's done enough for them and decide just not to vote than I do about Black voters who are let's be more specific. I actually think that the majority of these Black voters that they think they're going to replace with are male Black voters, right? Uh-huh.
Oh, yeah.
Black female voters have been the backbone of the Democratic Party since the 60s, right? And they ain't going anywhere. Now, there might be among younger Black voters a little drop off of enthusiasm, and that's what I worry about. But the Trump campaign thinks they are replacing some of these suburban voters with working class Black and Latino voters, particularly male when it comes to Black voters. And I think, they think maybe social conservatives when it comes to Latino voters.
What's the first thing they did when they took over the Republican National Committee? is they literally, the first thing they did is shut down the office that was focused on building support amongst Black and Latino voters.
Talk about cutting off your nose to spite your
literally
face.
The first thing they did. So maybe that was something that Ronna McDaniels was interested in doing, but it's definitely not something that Lara Trump is interested in doing. All right, so it's hard to see where they grow votes. So issues, what issues are they going to run on?
What abortion? I mean, he's bragging about getting rid of abortion.
Thank you, Donald.
Every chance he gets, he's like, I did that. They say it couldn't be done, and I did it, you know, and like, I was proud to have done it. You know, I mean, like, the thing is that it's not like the Democrats are going to have to work to find this video. It's all over the place. He's been doing town halls and radio interviews and TV interviews for the past year. It's all over.
The economy, like the vibe session seems to be, you know, fading away.
Let me give you a data point on this in the last 3 weeks, since we're talking about that. I mean, civics tracking looks at this question of, do you think President Biden is doing enough to create new jobs, right? So for instance, let's see, when early in his presidency, when he signed the Infrastructure Act, right? That was way back in late 2021, right? And 53% of people said, no, he's not doing enough to create new jobs. And 37% said yes. Okay, this week it's down to 48% no, 42% yes doing
enough.
That's
like that is 17 point net swing. That's an enormous swing.
I mean, it's over a while, but this has been slowly closing, you know, over time. And it's now 6 points out. Slowly closing over time, right? And it's coming to a point, and 6 points out is like the closest it's ever been. And that has happened really in the last 3 weeks, is where he's gained a couple points on both sides of that. So
abortion, the economy, like these are all issues that now play for the Democrats. Republicans are going to be left talking about, like we talked last week with Patrick Gaspard of the Center for American Progress. They're going to be leaning into security. So crime, they're going to be leaning into the border and even some of this cultural security stuff, the weird culture war issues that they get off on that nobody quite understands. I'm not sure any of those issues are really high value issues beyond their core 30% base. So
immigration is a top issue by far. I think there's a way that Biden can prosecute this campaign about immigration and, you know, immigrants and migrants and whatever in a sense and kind of battle them to a draw on this because they wouldn't come through with own bipartisan legislation. I mean, I think there's
really defanged that
there's
issue.
Raw material to work with for the Biden campaign here to say, hey, we are, and this is essentially what Tom Suozzi did in New York when he won that special election, is I'm here to solve problems. Yeah. I'm willing to reach across the aisle to solve problems. We legitimately had a bipartisan compromise that had a whole bunch of really good security stuff in it and whatever. And Donald Trump and Republicans tanked it. So, you know, I think that the more he leans into that argument, the more he can neutralize this whole idea that he's not doing enough and that somehow Trump is a guy who's going to be about solutions. I mean, you know, what Trump is promising to do is immediately start deporting, 11 million people or something
It's not practical. It's not a thing that's going to happen. But yeah, he's not serious. He's not really talking about solutions. And I think that's definitely, you're absolutely right. That's going to be an incredible cudgel. And you even have Trump now demanding debates from Biden. It's always the losing candidate that wants more debates. Political politics 101. If you're asking for debates, you're losing because you're desperate. It's the political elections version of a Hail Mary. After he said we're not going to do any debates and they're all rigged and this and that. Now he's asking for debates. I think he's feeling the heat. So I'm not sure what Republicans can point to right now. They're not even united as a party the way the Democrats are. So you don't even have a coordinated, ground up, unified machine that's pushing the Republican message. Are they going to have a platform this year at the convention? Of course not. Like they're not going to even have a platform like they didn't last time. they don't believe in anything except what Donald Trump wakes up believing in that moment, and maybe that morning, and maybe by mid-afternoon, he's changed his mind. Right. So they don't have the cohesive message. Democrats have a cohesive message of liberty. Thank you, Republicans, for giving that one to us on a silver platter. Like, you should have probably kept it, but they don't believe in liberty. They believe in autocracy and dictatorship, and they've given up on the democracy in general. So we are in an incredibly good place. And so what's left? What's left is people's fear of 2016. That's what's left. That, oh shit, like the polls said this and Hillary Clinton had money and therefore we lost. And there's a lot of differences between 2016 and now. In large part, Hillary Clinton was a woman and she was subject to a lot of misogyny and sexism and decades of attacks. And today I saw a memo from one of the party, Republican Party committee, saying, don't base your campaign on Joe Biden. It doesn't have any traction. The old white guy is not black, in all caps, Barack Obama, Barack Hussein Obama. Jeez. It's not Hillary Clinton. It's not any of their typical.
Can I just say, unless you're Donald Trump, because he seriously can't remember like who the difference between Barack Obama and Joe Biden, and is constantly talking about how Biden couldn't beat Obama. Well, you know what? Yeah. They were like in the same freaking administration, right? They were running on the same ticket, Donald. That's why Biden didn't beat Obama, is because, you know, I mean, like he is out to lunch. He says that he's doing this purposely. And I really think he just can't keep all his political enemies have melded into one. Haley's Nancy Pelosi, you know, Biden's Barack Obama, you know, it's all just sort of like.
And he'll sit there and he'll say it's artificial intelligence, deep fakes, whenever you run video of him stumbling on things and, oh, he meant it. Oh, it was a joke. No, he's Mr. Cognitive Decline. He does not look good out there.
Yeah, he does.
So I think it's a much different campaign. Does not mean any of us take it easy. Does not mean we sit on our butts and relax. It's literally, once again, the most important election in our lifetime. And I guess we're going to just lead into the send-off because that is our show for today. But I just want people to understand that it's okay to be optimistic. It's okay to look numbers and say, yeah, like we're going to win this thing. But we got to get out in the field and we got to play the game. I mean, nobody wins the game by sitting in the sidelines and having the team sort of like sit in their bench. And no, you still got to go out and play. And it's going to be tough. And they're going to throw everything they possibly can't add us, but the fundamentals are with us. If we do what we need to do, we don't even have to worry about what they do. We just have to take care of our own. Register people, get people out to vote, let them know about the issues that matter, why Donald Trump was the reason we lost our abortion rights, what it means if he wins, what he's promised. Mm-hmm. What he wants. And Carrie, we should do a show on their agenda, on the Heritage
Foundation.
Yeah,
we should do a show on what they promised.
Because literally what they promised. Yeah. We don't have to make stuff up. Like, no. They're telling us the autocracy that they're promising, the dictatorship that they're promising. So mm-hmm. We should definitely do a show on that. And just understand that we just got to do what we got to do. We got to play the game. We got to do the work. And it's not going to be easy. It's not going to be comfortable. But we win. Mm-hmm. We're done with Donald Trump. This is it.
Right.
This is the right. Final battle.
And I
battle.
Think there's, I just want to add another note of optimism. Like this is our chance. And I may have said this before, but I think it's worth remembering. This is our chance to write history, right? This is our opportunity as a generation, as a people, to make our contribution to American democracy and to write history during this time in which our democracy, our republic is truly under threat from within, right? And so this is our opportunity. But if we do it well and we win and we manage to, you know, to basically put the, you know, clenches or whatever on the Republican Party or Trump's MAGA Republicans, right? If we doom them enough, right? Democrats really have an opportunity to reshape this democracy in a way that's so much better than it was pre-Trump, that's so much more equitable than it was pre-Trump. We were starting to kind of go off the rails. And this gives us an opportunity to not only save our democracy, right, but to make it better, to make it closer to that perfect union that was originally the founders were looking at, right? So anyway.
That was beautiful, Carrie. Thank you so very much. Thank you for being my co-host. Thanks to Walter for producing the show, Perry for helping behind the scenes, and thank you, the viewer, listener, reader, for being part of this movement to rescue our democracy from the clutches of MAGA. Glad to have you by my side. Could not ask for better fellow travelers in this battle for our democracy. Thank you so much. Catch you all next week.